Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page. And remember, if you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? I'm Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, where each week I speak with experts in the fields of technology, science, finance, and culture to help you gain the tools to better navigate an increasingly complex world so that you're less surprised by tomorrow and better able to predict what happens next. My guest this week is former U.S. Senator and Governor from the great state of Nebraska, Bob Kerrey. Senator Kerrey currently serves as Managing Director at Allen & Company. He is also Executive Chairman of the Minerva Institute for Research and Scholarship. Senator Kerrey also served as one of the 10 members of the 9/11 Commission tasked with investigating the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. I don't often have the opportunity to speak with an elected official, let alone spend almost 2 hours in conversation with one. The overtime of this conversation, which includes a discussion about Senator Kerrey's work on the 9/11 Commission, the role that the Saudi government played in orchestrating the attacks, as well as my questions about why the Bush administration and the media refused to hold the kingdom accountable for its involvement, can be accessed through the episode page on our website. In this episode, Senator Kerrey and I discuss his experience growing up in 1950s and early 60s America, his service in Vietnam, and the life-altering injury that sent him down a path of service first as Nebraska's governor during the mid-1980s and later as its senator from 1989 to 2001. We discuss both the cultural as well as the political transformations that have overtaken American society throughout the course of his life, as well as how the media and social media have altered the political landscape and introduced new challenges to governing and elections that are altogether new. We discuss the tremendous wealth divide currently present in America, the role of the 2008 crisis and its aftermath in furthering that divide, and the emergence of populism, both on the left and on the right, as a powerful new force that is shaping American politics in ways that we are only just beginning to appreciate. What I'm most proud of, however, what I think makes this discussion most unique, is its civility. It is at times both provocative and pleasant, humorous but serious. It is a template for the types of conversations that we should all be able to have with people across the political spectrum, irrespective of our disagreements, in 2019 and beyond. And with that, I wish you all a happy new year, and let's get right in to this week's conversation. Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
It's great having you here.
Thanks for the animal crackers.
You're welcome. I love animal crackers. We have them here in the studio for guests. They're mostly actually for children, but I think for you and I, they're for the Sesame Street generation. So it's great having you here. We're recording this a few days before Christmas. We're actually recording it, you told me, on the anniversary of...
20th anniversary of the House impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Amazing. We're going to get into that because you were in the House at the time.
Senate at the time.
Senate. Sorry, right. You were in the Senate. As I said, you were a senator. You were also a governor.
Yes, I was.
You started as a governor of Nebraska.
Yes. Well, I started in business, and then I ran for governor, and then I went back to business, and the senior senator died, and so I ended up running for Senate.
I'm fascinated to learn about this. So I read your memoir, as I was telling you. Your memoir deals a lot with, I mean, some of it's your early life, but it deals a lot with Vietnam, and it deals a lot with your injury, the loss of your leg, and the recovery afterwards, and sort of your emotional and physical recovery. I told you I had, and the audience knows, I've had my own experience with a brain tumor. It wasn't war, but there are some similarities. I told you also that I read Ron Kovich's book, Born on the 4th of July. There were obviously more similarities between his book and your story, but I related to things between both of those. There are a number of things I want to speak to you about. One thing is, I heard, is this true? There's a rumor that you were born in the home of William Jennings Bryan.
That's correct.
How is that possible? How did you do that? How did you manage that?
Well, I didn't manage it at all. And you know, my mom made the decision. She and my dad was in the Army Air Corps, and there was a Army Air Corps base in Lincoln. And they were in down in Miami, which is where I was conceived. And then they got reassigned up to Lincoln. And she arrived just a couple of days before I was born. And I don't know why she went to, it was Bryan Memorial Hospital, but it was an overflow crowd, so it was at his house right next door.
Hmm. Conceived in Miami. That's a great place to be conceived. Warm weather.
Yeah.
Gets you in the mood.
Easy to understand. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's fascinating. You know, I read years ago, I think in 2012, I read Michael Kazin's book on the biography of William Jennings Bryan.
You're ahead of me. I have not read the biography of William Jennings
Bryan. Yeah, it's a great biography. It's a great story, actually. Yeah. You should know since you're from Nebraska. But fascinating, obviously. Fascinating, especially, you know, today, to know the history of the Free Silver Movement. And,
well, especially the rise of populism.
Rise of the original populist.
100%. Yeah.
The best, kind of, really. I mean, his speeches were incredible.
Yeah, actually, there was a guy by the name of Frank Morrison who was a governor of Nebraska before me, quite a while before me. But Frank was in his audience as a young man, probably very young man. But he said he had a voice unamplified that could be heard in very large auditorium. So he had a remarkable set of lungs.
Booming.
Yeah.
But I saw when I was preparing for the interview with Michael Kazin, I watched C-SPAN, which I love. I mean, C-SPAN is actually not even government funded, right? I think it's the cable companies.
That's correct.
Right, they fund it. Amazing, and it was footage from that home. So I've seen the home. I've seen the desk where William Jennings Bryan worked next to his wife. They worked in the same place. Anyway, so I've seen where you were born, Senator Kerry. I've seen you from the cradle.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. You're actually a city guy, even though you grew up in Nebraska.
Well, Lincoln is the state capital. It's a university town as well. But it's quite common to find people sort of first generation, second generation right off the farm. Because when I grew up, and it's still that way, but it was really that way when I grew up, the city limits are cornfields. So you ride your bike out to the edge of town, and you're in the country immediately. You know, at that time when I grew up, it was probably 100,000 people, 125,000 people. It's double that now. But so it's a city with lots of country characteristics.
So what years was that you grew up in Nebraska? Like, when were you a kid?
In the 50s. I was born in 43. So the poet Auden always had this question, which was, what's the first memory you've got of a public event? That is to say, a memory that other people would have as well. And mine was, you know, the test at NOAA talk of the hydrogen bomb.
Really? So, I think I remember you saying that in the book.
Late 40s.
Wow.
49, I believe that was.
What was that like? You remember that? What was your experience?
No, I just remember it. I don't remember what
it was.
I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, man, in fact, you'd see it. And at the time, I'm like, wow, that's really kind of beautiful, the big mushroom cloud. And I didn't comprehend the destructive power of it. I just saw this extraordinary event, and I knew it was important.
But, so what was America, I mean, specifically Nebraska, but what was America like in the 1950s?
Well, we were booming. I mean, most of the other countries on Earth had experienced devastation in the Second World War, and we had restrictions on what you could buy and how much you pay and so forth during the war. And boy, once those restrictions went off, it was boomtown almost everywhere. You know, manufacturing was hot, housing was hot. I got out of high school in 1961, and class was 330 or something like that. And in our family, we had one choice: University of Nebraska or, you know, almost nothing. But the kids in my class who went right straight to the workforce, you know, they went to work for half a dozen companies, all of which paid a wage that was enough to support a family, had pensions and health care when they retired. So all those jobs were available, and mostly available as a consequence of us not having the kind of competition that began to affect us in the 1970s.
How common was it for your generation, for kids that grew up particularly in the middle of the country, to aspire, if not want to go to war, to go to the military?
I don't know. I know I didn't. So I graduated from college in 1965. I went right to work. I finished a five-year program, a little over four. was practicing pharmacy, actually doing some research in pharmacy, and my draft status changed.
You knew that you were going to get drafted, so you figured you might as well apply to where you want
right.
to go.
Well, I knew I was going to get drafted. I passed my physical, and it never occurred to me. I had nasty childhood asthma, but in December when I took the physical, I was asymptomatic. So they said, you're ready to go. And I knew I was going to get drafted by the Army. And the only reason I went in the Navy because I just read the Kane Mutiny and Hooman Wolk's book about, you know, going to sea. And I said, well, that's for me. I'm going to go to sea. So I volunteered for the Navy.
Not just the Navy. You became a Navy SEAL.
Well, again, serendipity played a big role in it. I think when you're going to the Navy in the Fleet Reserve, then I applied for Officer Candidate School at Newport, Rhode Island, was accepted. And while I was there, a number of people came by, flight guys came by, and a friend of mine that I'd met there, we both applied for flight school. And he had something wrong with one of his eyes, so second choice was underwater demolition. And we applied for that, and he ended up getting called down to be interviewed by Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear Navy, because he was an electrical engineer. So he went off and did that, and I went to San Diego and went through underwater demolition.
So he was working in subs? Or
yeah, nuclear submarine program.
Really?
So I went out to San Diego and went through, or Coronado, actually, and went through underwater demolition. And when I was done with that, I got selected for SEAL team at the end of the class, mostly because, you know, the war was ramped up and they need bodies.
This was when, 67. Before you even tell me what SEAL training was like, what was it like being in the military at that time? I mean, did you know in 1966 that you were going to go to Vietnam?
No, I didn't. I mean, obviously the presumption is you volunteer for the Navy, you're not likely to go to Vietnam. And underwater demolition was the same way. Very few UDT teams deployed to Vietnam. In fact, I don't think any the time I was there. But SEAL team did. And SEAL team was relatively young. So, yeah, when I got selected for SEAL team, that's the moment I said, this is going to have a different ending than I thought I was going to have.
So, I mean, like, you have to be a really tough person to get through SEAL training. It doesn't just make you tough. You have to be tough, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you certainly have to be willing to endure, you know, a little bit of discomfort, to put it mildly. But I don't know that you necessarily have to be tough. I mean, I think you do have to, you know, there are certain physical things you got to be able to do, but the most important thing is your mental attitude. So
right. Yeah, but I mean, that's like the toughest thing, right? I mean,
well, it is. But in my case, I think I was helped actually by childhood asthma because I wanted to quit football. I wanted to quit particularly football because it was in the fall when the symptoms were at their worst. So, I mean, with underwater demolition training, there were plenty of moments where I wanted to quit, but I didn't. That's the toughness part of it, is just being able to say, no, I'm not going to do it.
We have a listener to the show, a listener who reached out to me, Army Ranger, or was an Army Ranger, and either I asked him or he brought it up about how he got through training, and he described it as going through a wood chipper. He said it's like...
Wait, from Fargo?
No. That's a great movie. That's a sick scene.
That's a sick scene. I went through Army Ranger School as well. We went to Airborne Ranger School back-to-back, and now they incorporated into the SEAL team training.
Well, he described it as going through a wood chipper in the sense that he said the only way he was able to get through it is when he just accepted that this is what it's going to be and that he just has to give his body into it, just kind of like going through a wood chipper. That's how I understood it. It's quite a visual he painted.
It is quite. I mean, I think in both cases, you have to learn to work with others. They don't call a SEAL team for nothing. And Rangers are even more because it's a larger entity. And I learned a lot from both those training programs and learned things that I apply to this day.
So you weren't in Vietnam very long, I think less than a year,
right,
before you got injured.
Right.
Tell me what that was like and what it was like, to the extent that you feel comfortable talking about it. I mean, it's been a long time, I know, but what that was like, not just the war, but the injury.
Well, I mean, first of all, I finished UDT and then Ranger and Airborne School and watched Lyndon Johnson in late March 1968 say he wasn't going to run for re-election, that he was going to negotiate an agreement with the North Vietnamese. And at that point, I mean, anybody that sort of processed what he was talking about knew we were going to finish second. We were not going to win this war. So the question was, how long were we going to be there before the politicians could negotiate an end?
So the public at the time pretty much felt that we were going to lose the war?
Well, I don't know about the public. That's a good question. I don't know.
The armed people in the military.
Well, one of the things that said about Vietnam is that they had to end it because it got unpopular. And that's not true. It was still, a majority of Americans still supported it. But it was, you know, if you're going to negotiate an end with another party and their objective, which is not negotiable, is that they want to control the entire country, the whole war effort was to preserve independent South Vietnam. I would say at that point the war was up. So I just tell you how I processed it in late March of 68 when I heard the president describe what he was going to try to do.
Where were you at that time?
San Diego, back out in San Diego.
You hadn't deployed yet?
No. Mm-mm. Right. You know, the great things about humans is that we forget pain. So you darn sure forget it if it began 55 years ago now in my case. So again, the most important thing I remember is that we were in a firefight when it happened, so we had to get all the way through that, and then
a lot of that memory has faded for you.
Oh, sure. So the joke is, you know the difference between a war story and a fairy tale? This is a bar story. So a fairy tale always begins once upon a time, and a war story always begins, no shit, this is true, I was there. So there is a tendency to forget. It just is. And it's not a bad
thing. Or to repress or to suppress.
Well, I don't know. It's just time. You know, time.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, so if you'd ask me right now, what was I doing yesterday afternoon? I'd have to scratch my head and try to remember what the hell I was doing yesterday afternoon, let alone what I was doing 55 years ago. So I do remember the pain. I remember the dramatic change in the circumstances of my physical condition. I mean, I went from, 185-pound seal to not being able to do anything without asking.
How tall are you?
5'11".
5'11", 185 pounds. You were pretty lean at the time?
Yeah. But by the time you finish that program, there's nothing that you can't do. I mean, that's how you feel. Now, there's lots of things you can't. But
And you were how old?
25.
I mean, that's kind of like what every guy wants to be, just jacked, athletic.
Yeah. Yeah.
In shape, looking great at that age.
Yeah. Yeah.
And tough, knowing how to do anything.
Yeah. No, it definitely
kind
worked.
Kind of Superman.
It definitely worked in the bars.
Did you kind of feel
that? Is that what you're saying?
I know you dated Deborah Winger.
Yeah.
We don't have
that
to talk
was later.
About,
that
I
was
actually later. Had a huge crush on her when I was a kid. I'm sure many in the audience know who she is. Many, I'm sure, don't. But yes, both in the bars, absolutely. But also just generally the feeling of being Superman. I mean, is that what it felt like? Kind of, did you
Not
feel
really.
Like Superman? No.
No. I mean, that's why I said people thought you were, but, they'd say, oh, my God, this guy's dangerous. But, I mean, some of them were, but I wouldn't call myself in that category. No, it's physically, if you said to me the day before I was injured, you said, I want you to go 100 miles from here to such and such a place, and you're going to be crossing four rivers, and you're going to be going over a mountain, and you're going to be, I'd say, okay, I can do that.
Wow.
Just give me the map, and I'll figure out how to get there. So in the Philadelphia Naval Hospital for almost 9 months, and I needed help to go to the bathroom.
This was in Australia? Where was this?
No, originally went to Yokosuka, Japan, and then went to, first went to a field hospital in Trang, then down to Cameron Bay, and then over to Yokosuka. All that time is about 4 or 5 days, and then most of the time I spent recovering and getting surgery was at Philadelphia at the Naval Hospital there.
Wow.
So you go from being able to do lots of things to being able to do almost nothing without asking somebody for help. And it's one of the challenges that men have in particular. We don't like asking for help. We don't like letting people take care of us. Mm-hmm. So it was startling to go from there to not being able to be mobile other than in a wheelchair.
I don't even know where to start with this. I mean, it's not like we can get through the whole, we could spend hours and try to extract some meaningful insight from your experience. I guess my question would be, how long did it take for you to kind of incorporate that experience into your life and to move forward into who you would become? And how important was the experience in making you who you are today?
Yeah, well, when you're in that kind of pain situation with, I would say, a very imprecise prognosis as to how long it's going to take him. I was discharged from the hospital 1 December 1969. I went back to Nebraska, and my last surgery was 1978.
Wow.
I mean, the last serious surgery that I had on my limb. So on the other hand, I'd started a business. We built a business. I was still doing a lot of things, but I would say wasn't able to do quite as much as I can today until 1978.
Oh, because of the surgery.
To me, the most important lesson is the government almost killed me by sending me to Vietnam, and that had saved my life. I wouldn't be alive were it not for the Philadelphia Naval Hospital.
The VA?
No, first the military hospital, naval hospital. And then secondly, when I was discharged, the VA, yes.
The health insurance that you have from the government.
It's not insurance.
Or the health care that you have. What would you call it?
What would I call it? I call it socialized medicine.
Socialized medicine.
And I'm just telling you, it certainly worked for me. Those people's... Without them, I wouldn't be nearly as mobile and as healthy as I am now.
I do want to talk about that as part of a broader conversation about political issues. In terms of historical point, one of the things that I wanted to ask has to do with what it was like when you came back from Vietnam, we've heard, so many of us have heard stories of what it was like for returning veterans. Mm-hmm. But it's something that I've reflected on a bit more because I don't know if it was preparing for your interview. I was just kind of thinking about what it would be like to go to war as a young man with certain expectations about what that meant. And then to come back and be surrounded by people my age who viewed me very differently and sort of all my expectations being shattered. What was that experience like, and why do Vietnam veterans talk about that so much when they reflect on the war?
Well, we haven't lost very many wars, and we lost this one. We finished second. We didn't win it. And even though the polling showed people, American people supported it, there was certainly no glorious feeling coming out of that war in the country as there was in the Second World War. Even Korea, which is a forgotten war, felt better because you get an armistice and at least South Vietnam survived, South Korea survived. So there's a bit of that. But the broader context of what was going on in the country in 68, 69, 70, 71 wasn't Vietnam. It was race. You know, like
Civil rights.
Oh, my God. 5 days after Johnson announces he's going to negotiate with the North Vietnamese in Paris, Martin Luther King is killed. And every major city in America was in flames, except for Indianapolis, where Bobby Kennedy happened to be campaigning. Talk the African-American community.
Right, that famous speech he gave on the back of a book.
But it was, you know, there were 2,000 bombings in 1970, and almost all of them connected to race. 25 dead. 71 is about as bad. So it was race it was driving in, and it was a movement to say, we have to change our culture, particularly, you know, the demands of women to have more rights in the workplace, and, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment rose and fell during that period. So it was a lot more than just Vietnam. It was an uncomfortable time in some ways because the country was changing.
So what you're saying is that the Vietnam War was part of this larger cultural movement in America.
I mean, if you ask me what was the most important thing going on as far as civil society in the late 60s, early 70s, I would say civil rights. It's busing. I mean, Richard Nixon, when he ran for president in 1968, he would have lost the nomination in Miami to Ronald Reagan had he not gone to Strom Thurmond and said, I'll give you every single federal judge, give you a veto over them because I want to slow busing down. He didn't say that explicitly, but that's exactly what was going on. Mm. And the big change that came about was he got 4 appointments to the court, including he got the opportunity to appoint Earl Warren's replacement. And that wasn't about Vietnam. That was about race.
Mm. So in the 1970s, when you came back and all of these changes were happening, you went back to Nebraska?
Yes.
And you got into business as an entrepreneur?
No, actually, I went back to Nebraska and applied to Stanford Business School, got accepted to Stanford Business School, went out there in the early summer of 1970, and I went to see the registrar. And the first thing he said to me was, oh, gosh, you're from Nebraska. You must really like Willa Cather. And
who?
I didn't know. Exactly. That's what I said. who's Willa Cather? You know, Pulitzer Prize winning Nebraska author in the early part of the 20th century. I didn't know who she was. So I went home, I went to our apartment there in Palo Alto, and I said, damn, I can't spend 2 years here learning finance and accounting, all that stuff. So I went to Berkeley, and I learned how to read at Berkeley for about a year and a quarter or something like that, and then came back to Lincoln to see some friends in between classes, and one of them said, you know, there's this guy coming into town, his name's Allard Lowenstein, and he's a former congressman, and, you know, let's go hear him talk. And his idea was we're going to register all the newly entered, because they just lowered the voting age to 18.
Now give us a timeline here. This is now what year?
71.
71, you're in Berkeley.
Yeah.
In 1971.
And 70 and 71.
71. What were you studying at Berkeley? English
literature?
English,
history.
Okay. You were just letting yourself get totally radicalized.
Not really. I had taken all science when I was in school. I mean, I was in college. I was in pharmacy, and I got out in 4 years. So I had an accelerated program, but not a lot of electives. And I didn't know how to read.
You didn't know how to read literally?
Well, no, I could decode words, but in terms of actually—
You had no experience with the arts and with literature.
No, I mean, to take a book, let's say you want to read Zorba the Greek. If you read Zorba the Greek and you get all the way done with it, the question is, can you tell me what the book was about? And I couldn't.
That's interesting.
And what I learned was what it meant to really learn something, to know something, to really know it, as opposed to being able to talk about it in a cocktail party. So that's where I learned to read. I now know what it means to be able to say, I just finished reading Frederick Douglass's biography. It's a remarkable story. And if you say, do you know that book? I'd say, not quite. I think I need to read it probably one more time in order to really be able to have a better command of what the author was saying. I mean, he took a lot of care to put that book out, to write that book, and I learned how to read. And it was enormously important to me to do that. It turned out to be a smart thing to do. Anyway, Lowenstein, the voting age got lowered to 18, and the battle cry was, if you're old enough to shoot, you're old enough to vote. I was in favor of raising the shooting age. That didn't happen. And I traveled with him, registering all these newly enfranchised 18-year-olds under the presumption that they would vote against Richard Nixon, and they ended up voting for him. So I did that, and then afterwards started business.
We didn't mention that you're a Medal of Honor recipient and that there's actually a picture of you, I have it in my rundown, receiving your medal from Richard Nixon, putting it on your neck, on your chest.
Right.
And you talked about how you were conflicted. You didn't know if you wanted it. Your parents were there. That must have also been a very emotional time, going to Washington, being there with the president, having your parents there after everything you were going through.
I mean, the dominant memory for me was pain. I was in a lot of pain. Physical pain, yeah. I don't know how much. I mean, this is May of 70. I was injured just a little over a year before that. And as I said, I had a fair amount of surgery after that coming my way. So standing up wasn't all that easy, and you stood up a long time and walking around. So, you know, I don't know how many aspirin I took, but it was well into double digits to get through the day. I had ringing in my ears. I remember that quite vividly. Look, I wrote medals when I was administrative officer, and so I knew that in order to get a medal, particularly a Medal of Honor, you have to have the action itself. Then the action's got to be witnessed. It's got to be witnessed by somebody who likes you. It's got to be witnessed by somebody who likes you, who can write, and then it's got to make its way up the mysterious process to decide. And so I knew there were lots of people who got nothing. And I was persuaded by a petty officer in Coronado, who I visited with while I was in the hospital, that I had to receive it for other people. And that's the spirit then and now.
Yeah, you wrote that you felt cynical about it.
And skeptical.
Skeptical, and that there was a lot of politics that you felt went into it for the Nixon administration, and Richard Nixon in particular. And we know a lot about Richard Nixon now.
Well, that was my relationship. I've never met President Nixon other than at that event, and I hated him.
You hated him before and after? How much?
No, after the war.
After the war.
I thought there are many people who told me, well, he didn't actually promise to end the war. He didn't have a secret plan. He didn't say he had a secret plan, but I felt like he did. And remember, the 68 election, this occurring after Johnson announces he's going to negotiate a peace. So the possibility of getting a peace negotiated seemed to be quite high.
Well, they say that he actively intervened in the negotiations in Switzerland, I think, right?
So the most important moment for me regarding Vietnam was really after I was served as governor. I ran for governor and won and was governor for 4 years, from 83 to 87. And a truly remarkable man by the name of Walter Capps, who was the chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, said, why don't you come out after you leave office and co-teach a class with me on the impact of the war on America? So I did. And full disclosure, I mean, if you have a choice between living in Omaha in January, February, March, or on the beach in Santa Barbara, you know, it wasn't that difficult a choice.
What year was this now?
1987. Yeah. So I go out there.
Go 80s.
And the first time I'd studied the war. And I began to understand how, you know, Eisenhower, well, actually it goes all the way back to Eisenhower, you know, supporting the French after they got in Indochina. I can understand how Kennedy made the mistake under Johnson. The Cold War was a ferocious battle between good and evil, as far as I'm concerned. And so it's easy for me to understand how all these guys, including Nixon, made mistakes. I went down to the beach one night after making that conclusion and shouted into the surf zone that I forgave Richard Nixon. And it's important because what I learned then was I'm 100% certain that Nixon didn't notice, but I noticed. I was the one who was suffering the hatred. I was the one that was being hurt by hating another human being. And once I stopped hating Richard Nixon, which I did, that sincerely did, I felt relief. So I don't come out of it saying, gee, Richard Nixon's a horrible human being. He had all kinds of issues to put a kind
for sure. Heard a lot of those tapes. I'm a junkie. I heard a lot of LBJ's tapes, Nixon's tapes, Kennedy's tapes. I must say, living in the United States, we have done a great job. Obviously, the vast majority of information is confidential, but we've done a great job of making a lot of that information available.
Oh,
and the internet has made that.
In the Ken Burns 17-part documentary of the Vietnam War, which has probably had a bigger impact in Vietnam than it's had here, there's a North Vietnamese soldier who at the end, one of the last of the shows, says, you know, I used to think that the demonstrations in the United States during the war was a sign of weakness. And he said, now I realize it's a sign of strength. Hmm. He said, we couldn't protest the war. And it's one of the things that's going on in Vietnam right now. They're coming to terms with what actually happened in Way City, what actually was going on to the work. They were, again, from that series, I didn't know it, but there were preteen girls driving those trucks down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So I do think that it is a sign of strength that we can protest. It is a sign of strength that we can say, we don't want to be in this war. We want to make change happen. I mean, we can tolerate that. And we need to tolerate that. We need to encourage our citizens to be watchful, up to, including pretty angry protests of what our political leaderships are doing.
You know, I'm still thinking about what you said around learning how to read. That's really going to stick with me. Just this idea of not just learning how to recite something, but learning what's meaningful about it. It sounds kind of what you're saying. And it's a skill that I wonder, I've never heard it sort of talked about like that. And I think that's something that everyone should be able to try and do. I try to do that when I prepare for these episodes, but there's a big difference between just learning, just reading something and remembering it versus drawing something out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you can get to a point with a book, Cliff's Notes, read the introduction, that allows you to have a apparently informed conversation at a cocktail party. Or
apparently informed. I love that,
yeah,
too.
Or you can learn it so that you get a profound understanding of what this artist was saying with his story, and you may not be able to have a conversation with anybody. But it can change the way you see life, the way you see other human beings.
So 1987, you were howling into the wind in Santa Barbara on the beach. You had just finished your four terms as governor in Nebraska.
Four years.
You ran for re-election, but did you lose?
No, I ran one term and then chose not to run a second term.
Interesting.
In fact, I would not have gone to the Senate had I not gone to Santa Barbara and study the war and get an understanding of the foreign policy, both the good and the bad. And all of a sudden, the senior senator in Nebraska died, and the governor who followed me is a Republican. She appoints a Republican, and the seat for a Democrat is essentially open. So if I had run for a second term and remained as governor, I would never have run for Senate.
It sounds like what you're saying happened for you in 87 when you studied the war was that you gained a larger appreciation for the complexity and the nuance?
Well, yeah. I knew this going in. Some of it came from having been governor. So I'd been governor before, and you get in these executive positions like that, and legislative can be the same way, except there you're just dealing with a vote. And you get this moment, and the choices aren't good versus bad. The choices are usually bad and not so bad, or good and not so good, or, you know, you really—
Shitty and worse.
Yeah, you don't get a moment where you say, oh, I'm going to do this because it's great, and if I don't do it, it's horrible. So it's—
I feel like we're really bad candidates.
Right, and so you end up with something I think is— I've learned over time, which is to be sympathetic. And it's one of the gifts I've got from being injured. Yeah. I can see pain that I previously wouldn't have seen. So, you know, having the capacity to be sympathetic is a really good thing.
I can relate to that. Yeah. Did that fade at all? Or is it as strong as it was when you first
came out? If I'm fighting to get on a subway, it fades immediately.
You're like, that guy's going down.
Yeah.
But a lot stuck around, right? I mean, for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like I'm walking around like
Jesus,
the Dalai Lama or something. But so I'm a long ways from being perfect. But when I stop and consider and look around me, I'm able to see pain.
You've experienced suffering.
Yeah.
And that's given you...
And I've experienced what it takes to end that suffering, or at least substantially reduce it. It was government action and non-government action. It was both. I mean, people just coming in and volunteering their time and helping me out. I mean, it's, yes, the Naval Hospital and the VA Hospital, an enormously important part of my recovery, but it was friends, family, and strangers that did an awful lot as well.
So 1987, you run for the Senate. How difficult was that election?
Well,
was it a shoo-in?
No, actually, I made the decision late in 87. The race was 88.
88.
Was it a shoo-in? No. There was a very attractive Republican senator who had been appointed to the position. We had, at the presidential level, and it tends to matter, Herbert Walker Bush was the top of the ticket on the Republican side, and Mike Dukakis was the top of the ticket on the Democratic side. And the government, he made a couple of mistakes.
he rode around in a tank in that famous video.
Right. So I won by a relatively comfortable margin. But it was also difficult because as a governor, I really didn't know the national issues. And you got to learn them. So, you know.
Did you like campaigning?
It's an answer that is going to be yes and no. You know, there's lots about campaigning that it's difficult. You're raising money, for example. But overall, they're fun. I mean, young people get opportunities to have responsibility way beyond what they're typically going to have. You meet and make friends that are with you forever. You remember the campaign of 82, the campaign of 88, 94. You remember these things. And you become friends with people that typically that are on the other side. So,
well, yeah. I mean, what's his name? Mary Magdalene.
Right. Yes.
James Carville. James Carville.
So I would say yes. I'm saying yes mostly because people who are listening need to take a shot at it. It's not all pleasant. It's not like you're going to the beach, but because it's work and it's intense and changes every single day. So I enjoyed them.
I wonder if that relationship would have worked out between Carville and Magdalene if the shoe was on the other foot, if she had won.
If she had won?
I don't know if that would have worked.
I don't know.
She stepped in after Lee Atwater passed away and she took over the Bush HW campaign, right?
Yes.
But it was originally Lee Atwater. He was going to be the campaign manager. But he died tragically of a brain tumor. And you, of course, not only did you run twice for the Senate and won both times, right?
Yes.
But you also ran for president in 1992. I read that you were somewhat reluctant to do it. You weren't 100% on board.
Well, mostly because I wasn't fully prepared. I really had not been giving—
Who was pushing you to run?
Oh, it's entirely me. I mean, there are people saying, if you do it, I'll support you, but it's—
But was it kind of those things where a lot of people were like, come on, this is, you know,
no,
we don't—
No, you
really,
can't, no.
This I mean, is entirely
you. People encouraging, you have to be careful with that, because you think, God, everybody wants me to run. Well, can you define everybody for me? And then you make a list of everybody that tells you you should run, and maybe you have 50 people. You need 100 million votes to win.
So you're saying a lot of people say that to make themselves sort
no,
of—
No, it's just they'll say it and they're sincere about it, but it's still a small number.
Oh, yeah.
So you really, and anytime you're running for office, I do think it's important to recognize, and I think it's likely to occur in the next 10 years, these guys that are working with human DNA, that they'll find a base pair which instructs everybody who becomes a candidate for office to be, I'd say, 25% more self-delusional than everybody else, right? I think we're all a little delusional. That's how we get through life. But those of us who've run for office, there's this delusion that we say, gosh, if they just get to know me, they'll vote for you. It never occurs to you to say, is it possible? If they get to know you, they won't vote for you. So I think you really have to be careful not to presume that if they just get to know you, you're going to be able to win, or that you don't want to do it. I remember asking Bill Clinton, when did you decide? Oh, he said, I was thinking about it all the way back in the early 70s. But he said, I asked Jimmy Carter, he was governor of Arkansas at the time, asked President Carter if I could spend a night in the White House. I wanted to see, he said, what it was like to sleep in the White House. Would I like it? Yes or no? And he said, I liked it.
Well, not only did he like it, Bill Clinton, of all the presidents that I've studied, seems to be the one that was most reluctant to leave, most reluctant to leave the White House. In fact, he said that one of the anecdotes I've heard about Bill Clinton, and he's repeated it often, is that it took a long time for him to get the song out of his head, the Hail to the Chief, out of his head.
Yeah.
Because he said everywhere you'd walk into a room, they'd play Hail to the Chief.
Right. All of them missed the plane.
Everyone says that.
Oh.
Everyone says that.
Yeah.
Have you been on Air Force One?
Yeah, I have. It's pretty cool.
Well, George H.W. Bush, he had a brand new plane, right? He was the first one to have that Air Force One that Clinton also had, and then I guess got retired with Barack Obama. I don't know. But I think he had a brand new jet, and I read one particular anecdote where he used it, and I don't know which senator he was campaigning with, but he wanted to get a vote. And he took the senator on the plane, and by the time the flight was over, he's like, you have my vote, Mr. President. But I could never, ever run for anything just on account, separate from anything else. I'd be not just self-conscious, yes, self-conscious, but also I feel like losing would be devastating. Like telling people, do you like me? Vote if you like me. If you don't like me, don't vote for me.
Losing is nowhere near as devastating as winning and not knowing what the hell to do when you're done. So
you were like Robert Redford in The Candidate?
No, I was not like, but yeah, I would say when I ran for Senate, kind of, except I dealt with the Senate. I wasn't totally baffled, but there was a lot I had to learn. I would go over and listen to oral arguments at the Supreme Court just to get a better understanding of the relationship between the Constitution and the law and to get a better understanding of the ideological differences. I mean, when Earl Warren read the Constitution, he saw something different than when Warren Burger read the Constitution. And when you hear people say, well, they just call balls and strikes, that's nonsense. They don't call balls and strikes. They bring their ideology to bear, and the ideology is, what's the role of government? What should we use, the original interpretation of the Constitution, or should we modify it as society changes? And I had to learn the rules of the Senate. So there's lots that I didn't know going in, and it wasn't quite like Redford, now what do I do? But a little bit, because you got to figure it out.
You didn't know where you stood.
Well, I kind of knew where I stood, but, you know, when we campaigned in 88, Dave Carnes, who was the incumbent senator, and I, it was the big debate in foreign policy was, should we build the MX missile? It was all about national security.
What was the MX missile?
It was a part of our nuclear armament against the Soviet Union. Do we need it? It was
the bigger, more badass nuke?
Oh, it was MIRV, I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it had 10 warheads on a single missile, and each of them were 10 times a blast of Hiroshima. So it's to put it mildly, a nasty weapon. But the only point is, the Soviet Union was still there.
No.
So I get elected in 88, and 89, the Berlin Wall comes down. And by 91, the Soviet Union's not there any longer. And all of a sudden, what do I got to learn? The difference between Shia and Sunni. We don't have a bipolar world. It's a single...
The end of history.
Well, except it didn't turn out to be the end of history.
No,
so
didn't.
Trying to understand when we should intervene and when we shouldn't intervene, how to build our weapon systems, not just for today, but for 20 years from now, those are oftentimes brand new propositions that you didn't campaign about.
What committees were you on in your first term?
I was on agriculture, I was on appropriations, and I was on intelligence.
So you were saying about coming to a better understanding of where you stood. You had some idea, but you weren't the man you are today in terms of your ideas. How did that happen? How did you kind of come to a political identity? It sounds like that was sort of forged during your time in the Senate.
Oh, I would say yes. I mean, if you asked me to write an essay on my ideology in 1988, I would have been incomplete compared to what I would do today. Because the lessons are, I'll give you an example of a lesson. So in 1990, that was President Bush's first budget. That was the budget that set in motion the balancing that occurred in 1997. Democrats gave him far too little credit because he'd given the speech.
Raised taxes.
But relatively modestly. But one of the taxes was to...
Good luck doing that today for a Republican.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were paying down debt at the end of the decade, and it began with him. So
twin deficits.
Yeah. So you start off with, and I'm saying, okay, that should, we'll get this thing done. We're going to have to raise a little taxes and cut our spending back. So one of the things in that 90 bill was a big tax on luxury yachts. And you say, well, that's easy. All these rich guys, I think, pay a little bit more money. It shut down the boat building industry in Rhode Island. So we had to reverse it because we put them out of business.
You put the Rhode Island boat manufacturers out of business.
They went from whatever it was to zero practically overnight.
So probably, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Warren Buffett once told me, gave me really good advice all the way through, but one of the things he told me was, don't try to change human nature. Try to write a law so that when people satisfy whatever's in their rational self-interest, you got a desirable outcome. Well, you're talking about 330 million people now. Mm. So this is a big country. So you'll do something you think is going to go due north and ends up going due south. And you don't get a do-over with a vote. But the vote, you go down there, you got two choices, yes or no. And the most difficult moments are when you're 51% certain it ought to be yes, and then 2 days later, you're 49% certain it ought to be yes. You can't walk back down to the floor and say, I'm going to change my vote to no. You vote yes, and that's recorded as a yes. You vote no, it's recorded as a no.
So what is that like, that the legislative process, the process of reviewing a bill, coming to determination, casting a vote, living with the repercussions, attempting to think about all the possible repercussions that you couldn't foresee. I mean, a great example is criminal justice, how it was practiced by Democrats in the 90s, and now the way that people view the repercussions of that.
Yeah,
war.
Although we forget how violent the cities were as a consequence of crack cocaine. So, I mean, it wasn't like we were sitting around in the Garden of Eden. The American people were saying, do something about violent crime. And they didn't regard a drug kingpin as a nonviolent criminal, even though he wasn't killing anybody. There were people dying as a consequence of the consumption of the drug. So it's easy today to look back and say, why did you guys do all that stupid
stuff? Does that happen?
Do
you think that happens a lot where people look back and judge people in the past based
on... Oh, sure. Sure. And it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing if you're willing to push a little further to try to understand it. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm reading a biography right now of Winston Churchill. And some of his attitudes on race at the time, oh my God. And he, you know, he was writing a book every 60 seconds practically. So there's plenty of recorded observations that he was making about imperial Britain and its importance of maintaining the empire and all that sort of stuff. So, yes.
Well, Woodrow Wilson had filmed Birth of a Nation at the White House. And
he was a Southern racist.
Yeah. But it's ridiculous to look back and judge people, to judge Woodrow Wilson based on the standards of today, or to judge Thomas Jefferson, who was a slave owner, based on today's standards. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I don't think it's bad to observe it, that it happened. I don't think it's bad to say it, but it certainly doesn't make Woodrow Wilson a terrible human being. It doesn't eliminate all the good things that he accomplished as well, and likewise with Jefferson. So
it would make him a psychopath if you brought him back to, if you brought him to today. But point is, he was living when he was living.
If you go back and look at the laws of the United States in 1800, it looks barbaric compared
it was
to
barbaric.
Right. So, yeah, I do think it's one of the things we tend to forget.
You they had duels.
Yeah, I know. I mean, right over in Weehawken, Alexander Hamilton got shot.
Exactly.
So, people will say today, God, it's terrible today. It's never been this bad. I say, get out of here. 700,000 men died because we couldn't figure out how to end slavery without a civil war. So it has been a lot worse than it is today.
Like you said, also 1968, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, 63, the president of the United States, murdered in the streets of Dallas.
The protests against busing were violent.
The protests against busing, civil rights. 1974, Ford was shot, right?
Right.
81, Reagan was shot. I mean, we've had it really easy by comparison.
Right. So what's it like in the Senate? So you get to the Senate, and I say one quick thing. When somebody gets up and gives a speech and says, Washington, D.C. is broken, I'm going to go there and fix it, that is unadulterated horseshit. I can break a glass. There's things I can break. You cannot break the Capitol. You certainly can change rules, and people need to say, what kind of rules do you want to have? What should the rules of the Congress be? What should the rules surrounding campaign finance reform or whatever you want? Yes, the rules can change. But when you're changing a rule, the next question is, can you persuade 535 people to change the rule? I arrive in the Senate in 1989, get sworn in by George Herbert Walker Bush. I'm one of 100. I actually am one of 535. Because it isn't enough for me just to persuade 51 senators to vote for an amendment I've got. I've got to get it past the House. I've got to get it through conference. It's a process. And the process almost always requires me to yield a little bit of ground to get what I want. There's compromise necessary in order to get a majority. If you go out in the streets of New York and get 10 people and bring them in a room and have them decide you're going to go north, south, east, and west when you leave here, you know, you probably have 3 want to go north, 3 want to go south, 2 want to go east, 2 want to go west. And you say, I'm sorry, you can only go one direction.
So somewhere stay put.
So the 10 of you have to decide. The 10 of you make a decision which way you're going to go. And guess what happens? You vote, 6 say north, and the other 4 have a different choice. Mm. When you're all done, you all got to go the same direction. So one of the questions that happens in politics, and I've had so many people that have gone in and they get frustrated and bitter by it. You know, what do you do when you lose? Well, you keep going. People say, well, I passed that law and now it's changing. Democracy is always moving. We amend our constitution. We change according to now how do we view the world. So, yeah, it can be massively frustrating because you don't walk in there and say, gee, I think we should do X, Y, and Z and have everybody give you a standing ovation. Say, yeah, well, we're all with you, Bob. I mean, I had things I wanted to do that I never got done. Maybe I could persuade 2 or 3 people over a 12-year period that I was right, and that was it.
When did things change? How did we go from the stories I read about Tip O'Neill and Reagan and the Congress and the executive and the relationship within Congress in the 80s and before to what we have today? How did that happen? How would you compare what it was like when you were senator?
Well, there's 2 things. One is you see it, and we didn't used to see it, whether it's C-SPAN and now you've got...
How the sausage is made.
Yeah. I mean, I see it, and I can penetrate the veil, and I know what's going on. I can see stupid people. I can see really smart people. I can see cowards. I get to see stuff that in the old days, up until 2002, I couldn't see it. So
we saw Ken Starr. We saw the Ken Starr.
We did. We did all the
way. I watched that on C-SPAN as a kid.
Even then, a lot of it gets missed. I mean, the most recent one was when Kavanaugh was being considered.
That was brutal.
It was brutal, but when they showed the Anita Hill questioning, when that occurred in 1991, if you wanted to watch that hearing, you had to sit in front of a television set. That's how you had to watch it. if you're there before the Senate or you're in the Judiciary Committee, you get to see it up close and personal. But if you want to see what those questions were, you had to watch it on television. So if you're working in the afternoon when those questions were asked, you could maybe...
Oh, I see what you're saying. You maybe had to watch it on a broadcast. You couldn't catch it afterwards is what you're saying.
I can't go to YouTube and call it up.
I see what you're saying.
So in the Kavanaugh hearing, people were going to YouTube and calling up and watching what Hal Heflin said to Anita Hill. "You look to me like a woman scorned," he said to her. Whoa. And I loved Hal Heflin.
No one could say that now. Joe Biden was tough on her too, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, God. But they all were. But they were saying things that, all I'm saying is, today with the Kavanaugh hearing, I just go to the computer and pull up the whole darn hearing or 5 minutes of it or 10 minutes. Everybody's blowing all things all over the place.
What do you think about that? What do you think, not about the hearing in general, but the spectacle of the Kavanaugh hearing? Do you think it was a spectacle? It seemed like a spectacle to me.
Yeah, but I was on the commission that George Mitchell put together to investigate the question of there are POWs in Vietnam. This is 1991. And it was a contentious, difficult process. And John Kerry chaired it. John McCain was on it. I was on it. A couple other people that had been in Vietnam were on it. I mean, we had some screaming matches. But you didn't see it. So it was a spectacle, but it was an unobserved spectacle.
But that makes it different, right? I assume that the spectacle, don't senators and congressmen act very differently, and women very differently, if they know that the camera is on and people are watching versus closed?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and by the way, every now and then, somebody proposes to put cameras in the Supreme Court, and I've opposed it every single time.
Sounds like a horrible idea.
It's a horrible idea. I go down there a couple times a year to listen to oral arguments still, and I never leave without saying, well, this thing works. Because you can't be a populist in the court. You can't be a demagogue in the court. You either present your argument in a persuasive way or you don't. And when it's all done and they put their order out there, thanks to John Marshall, that decision is final.
But it's a shit show now. I mean, it's a shit show. People...
What do you have against shit shows? I mean, come on.
Well, if they're in the government...
It's messy.
But isn't it more than just messy?
So
let me ask you this, for example. I'm the least expert person in the world when it comes to politics. Let's just take redistricting, for example. As I understand it, the incentives in primaries have changed to such a degree that we have extremely polarizing candidates being elected. So the polls are dragging out the center. And now we're getting people in Congress who also apparently are spending far less time in Washington than they used to be and flying home to not just be with their constituents, but to raise money. And that's another huge thing, right? How big of an issue is that? The fact that these congressmen and women spend between 30 and 70% of their time on the phone trying to raise money?
What's your question?
I'm
kidding.
My question is, look, shit show.
What it provokes in me is, what do you want the rules to be? For example, we have not changed the rules about the number of Americans in a congressional district since 1920. What does that mean? That means there's no accommodation being made for the significant movement of people from rural areas to urban areas. And what it means is urban areas get underrepresented. And I think it's now 700,000 people for each congressional district. That's how it's apportioned. And it probably ought to be 300,000. But that means the House is going to get bigger if you do that. So the rules of the Congress are set by the Congress themselves. I don't know why Madison thought that was okay. It probably was early on. I don't think it is okay now. It does produce more difficulty, and I would say the middle ground being able to have more power. The power has been moving over away from the committees over to the leadership. So there's a number of things that I would change, but it's about changing the rules. It's about changing the rules, so not so you don't have a shit show, because we're going to have arguments.
That's different. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying right now I believe there's in a number of areas the rules need to change. Gerrymandering happens to be one of them. I think what California has put in place is better because you end up with representation that's much, much closer to how the people themselves are voting. It's an open primary. I think ranked choice, which was done up in Maine, is a preferred system because it means a third-party candidate come in and doesn't have to worry about being a spoiler. So there's a number of changes, and I think campaign finance reform happens to be it, although I personally think the only way you're going to get from where we are to where we need to be is by amending the Constitution, because you've got a couple of serious Supreme Court decisions, the biggest one being Buckley v. Vallejo, that limits the Congress's capacity to put limitations on what could be spent.
So you think, I mean, how important of a priority? There are people that have made that the hill they want to die on. I don't know about in Congress, but someone like Lawrence Lessig, for example, I don't know if I mentioned it during the show to you or before, but he thinks that is the single most important issue facing Congress, because if that doesn't get solved, nothing else can get solved.
I disagree with that. I think it's important, but I don't think it's the single most important thing. You could have public financing a campaign, it won't necessarily produce better candidates. I mean, part of the problem is you've got 75% of the American people can name all three of the Three Stooges and can't name a single member
of
the
Supreme. Dumber than they used
and
to
can't
be?
Name, I don't think we're dumber than we used to be, but we might be. I just don't think.
You're saying we've always been this stupid? That doesn't really make me feel a lot better.
No, but democracy's always been vulnerable to that. From the beginning, there was nervousness about it. I mean, you could only vote if you had...
I mean, we're pretty stupid today. I don't know. No, I was actually kind of hoping that your answer...
No, but the founder said... You don't get a vote unless you're white and have property, white male and have property. They limited the franchise, and as the franchise grew, you know, the old guys, Adams and Jefferson, were saying, oh, my God, we're going to get riffraff. And the big riffraff, the big moment, the first time that you had all men and all white men could vote was the year that Andrew Jackson won. So it's always been that the most dangerous force in democracy is uninformed public opinion. And we have a Republican form of government, which means I'm not supposed to, you know, lick my finger and hold it up to the wind and figure out what the public... I'm not supposed to read polls and say I'm only going to vote what the polls tell me to vote, because it may be that the public has reached a conclusion that's wrong. It may be that my job is to explain to the public that they're wrong and try to educate them. And it may be not the worst thing in the world to cast a vote that you believe is right and lose as a consequence.
So you mentioned two things there when you were talking that I want to use as... seeds or pegs for further conversations. One is you mentioned Andrew Jackson and populism, and mm-hmm. I really want to discuss the resurgence of populism today, mm-hmm. I think both on the right and on the left. And the other one is you mentioned property rights and that the founding fathers required that you own property. The reason they required that, of course, was because they were terrified that people without property, and particularly mobs, would take over the government. I think what's interesting about, let's start with that one with property. How big of a deal is it that the distribution of wealth, forget income, let's just talk about wealth, ownership of America has shifted so dramatically and we have such a greater concentration of wealth today than we had 20, 30, 40 years ago?
First of all, I think it's a problem that typically when the expression, a populist expression, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. That's the populist expression. And oftentimes, in fact, if not all the time, the person speaking then proposes things that have to do with income. It has nothing to do with wealth. I'm going to raise the minimum wage. I'm going to help people buy health insurance. I'm going to make the safety net more generous. I'm going to make it easier for you to go to college. These are income issues. These aren't equity issues. So I think it is a big, big problem. But I don't think you solve the problem by redistributing wealth. Because part of what's happening is you're getting phenomenal wealth, particularly the last 20 years, being generated by a relatively small number of people. It's not like...
Also stolen. The 2008 crisis, for example, a huge wealth transfer occurred with the bailout, not primarily the federal government, but through the Federal Reserve. Basically, the way in which the financial sector blew up a tremendous amount of debt, and then a select number of people were rescued and asset prices continued to rise. That was a huge wealth transfer.
It was a huge wealth transfer. You get the same thing happening, by the way, when you try to get the economy going again by dropping interest rates practically to zero. It's a transfer of wealth because people that have saved, they're the ones that get punished. So, yeah.
And retirees, for God's sake.
There's no question that there are policies independent of everything else, of some dramatic moments, and 2008 was the biggest one. I mean, TARP may have been the most unpopular piece of legislation ever to pass the Congress, and they should have. In my view, they should not have paid out 100 cents on the dollar for people that were owning credit default swaps and doing all these other financial engineering things that they should have made them pay, and they didn't. They didn't have to do 100% in order to be able to make certain that we didn't have a financial meltdown that ruined everybody. But if you're sitting out there with a 401k in 2008 and it goes from enough and you're 65 years old and you're about ready to retire and your 401k becomes a K and you're watching, within a year, the bankers are back getting the same kind of bonuses as they were before, you look at that and say, that's not right. And you're right. It isn't right. But I don't think you solve the wealth distribution problem personally.
And I'd agree with you on that.
Well, I think you got to start by saying, what is wealth? And you got to help people when they come into the workforce over the course of their lifetime acquire the capacity to get a second check. Because if all you got Social Security when you're done working, and in today's workforce, we've gone from almost everybody in the workforce having defined benefit retirement programs or 401ks, and 401ks don't even come close.
Well, we have a huge unfunded liability bomb, taking time bomb. That's a huge, I mean, that's another, we didn't even touch that one.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that a relatively small amount of wealth generated over the course of a life can make the difference between living in poverty and not living in poverty when you start drawing Social Security. If you only have Social Security as a source of income, you're going to be in poverty. And there are ways to do it. There are ways to say, I would start at birth. I would say we're going to create a savings account for every one of the 4 million live births in the country, and we're going to contribute on a progressive basis, meaning that you got to get like $800 or $1,000 a year, and it can only be used at that moment you draw Social Security to be converted into income.
What do you mean? I don't understand. You're saying when someone is born, the government sets up a savings account for them?
Yes.
How would that work?
Well, a range of ways it can work. I mean, first of all, it become a self-funding mechanism. As if you start off by saying, yeah, I think you have to make the investments relatively safe. You can't have people turn their investments over you because the money is going to get lost in fees. So there's other things you've got to do besides saying, how are you going to fund it? But I think, yes, I would say that I would personally take it out of the income tax. Maybe I'd do it by taking off the cap on income that's taxed for Social Security. If you're really trying to do this in a way that allows you to say that you're helping lower income people accumulate wealth, it might be that.
But wasn't that a form of redistribution? Wasn't that what you were talking about?
Everything we do.
You're
not redistributing assets. Redistributing assets mean you've got a home that's worth $5 million, you've got stocks and bonds worth $10 million, or you're Bill Gates and you start a company and you're worth billions, whatever. I don't want to go in and attack that wealth and take it and redistribute it.
Oh, you're talking about like Leninist Russia there.
Yeah,
that would be like a full-blown communist revolution if they took everyone's assets.
Well, yeah, but even if it wasn't communist, even if you say, well, no, that's what Adam Smith proposed, the mechanism to do it is exceptionally difficult. And Piketty, the economist, is actually proposing some mechanism to do it, but I think it's unworkable. It's far better, in my view, to begin, first of all, by saying income, and as you did as you started the question, that income and wealth are two different things. And it is possible. For everybody that's born in America, it is possible to create a trajectory where by the time they draw Social Security, whether it's 62, 67, or 70, whenever they start bringing it in, that they've got another source of income besides that. It is possible to do that, but you got to start early.
Are you talking about universal basic income?
No.
UBI?
No, universal basic wealth generation as a consequence of saving over a long period of time.
Well, let's look at some more practical issues. For example, you work
pretty
in...
practical.
Well,
that's actually a good example of something that I and about 10 other people out of 535 members of Congress were for. So
that's
it's a good example of an idea that I had that you're not the first person to think it was impractical.
So let's talk about something that maybe the word practical is not the right word, something that's more tangible, we can get our hands around, our minds around, which is tuitions. And you've worked in education. I was telling you before we started recording, I had breakfast this morning with two students, one freshman at NYU and another one, a sophomore at Stanford. The last time I calculated the cost of going to NYU is when I had Jonathan Haidt on the show, and I thought it was $72,000, including room and board. But they actually told me it was closer to $80,000. I don't know if they were exaggerating. But they were calculating books and things like that.
If you're charging students, you round to 70. If you're paying it, you round up to 80.
Exactly. Right. So, but regardless, I had done interest payments on that if you were to take that out as student loans. And there's just no way that you can build a life going to college.
Well, I think the question for NYU, before you can get into the conversation, is what's the average debt going out as a graduate of the undergraduate program, because whatever that 72 is probably their gross price.
Right.
I don't know what their average debt is.
Sure.
I know at the new school was about $15,000 of debt when they the undergraduates. So at the graduate level, it can be more expensive. Every single day that goes by, we set a new record in student debt.
What's interesting, though, is that they were both young women, girls. I mean, I don't know what you would call someone who's 19 or 18. Another shocking experience, by the way. I mean, I want to also speak to you about your experience on the 9/11 Commission. These kids were born, they have no memory of 9/11.
No kidding.
No.
They shouldn't. They were born before, born after.
Well, they were born right before, right around there. But that's crazy. That's just, to me, that's just, it's nuts.
It happens.
Time. Well, that's my experience with you in the war, right? So, but the thing that they said that really blew my mind was, it wasn't so much what they said, it was that they really just kept talking about the wealth disparity on campus. And their anecdotes about how wealthy the fellow students were at Stanford and NYU was just kind of blew my mind.
Right.
I mean, I went to NYU, and I remember there were a lot of rich kids there, but it wasn't something that people really flaunted. There were some circles of people that did, especially the Stern students. But, you know, it wasn't what they described. And again, it's not big for me, the inequality or disparity of wealth, because it's some sort of progressive issue that I look at from some kind of progressive lens or some kind of conservative lens. And it's more just a problem. And I don't see it being resolved through legislation, at least not right now. And what I see is it filtering into an already, I think this is happening, into our politics. And that brings us to Andrew Jackson and populism. And I think there's a brand of populism on the right, which is more nativist, focused on, the stuff that you're seeing through the Trump campaign. But there's going to be a populism that's coming on. Bernie Sanders shows some of that. You might be seeing some of that with Ortiz. And Warren, of course.
Right.
Elizabeth Warren, who it looks like increasingly will run in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have any special insight, being a former senator, if you know anything.
about what?
I'm just saying, I don't know. I know there's like a special, you know, room where you guys go smoke cigars and pick candidates. I'm messing with you.
There's a special place where we go and take some of the new medical cannabis, but we're not reliable at that point.
Okay. So I think that's an emergent trend in politics, populism. And it's not something that we've seen since when? Since Goldwater?
Oh, look, I don't know. I think since Ross Perot, there's always, put it this way. Say, let's say you tell me that you want to run for the Senate, but you're not certain whether you want to run as a Republican or Democrat, but you want to make health care your big issue. Hmm. So, okay, so I can write a speech that you could give to a Republican audience on the issue of health care that would get you a standing ovation. I could write you a speech that you give to a Democratic audience that would get you a standing ovation. Both are populist and both are lies, but the audience would love it. Get the government out of health care is a standing ovation from the Republican audience. High quality, affordable health care for all is a guaranteed standing ovation in a Democratic audience. And
I can't deal with herd mentality.
No, I know, but we're,
herd animals.
We haven't been out of the herd that long. So we're just, the whole idea of history is to examine how we're beginning to civilize ourselves. So, I mean, there are times in populism.
Beginning to civilize ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a ways to go. So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with populism, but if populism blames somebody else for your problems. But
isn't that what populism is?
Well, kind of. It doesn't always have to be, because maybe it's right. Maybe the group of people you're targeting are screwing everybody else. If you're going after, when Teddy Roosevelt said, we got to bust up the trust, he was right. When you talk about anti-competitive environment, I would say with Facebook and Google and these guys, I mean, they're running the show. Maybe it's okay. Maybe they think that's fine. You don't want to make a change. So there are times when you're identifying something that is causing a problem and there's something you can do about it. But if you're blaming somebody else for a problem, you're encouraging people to think that they don't have to do anything. You just have to whack the guys that are causing the problem. You know, that said, back on the education thing, there is no question. And all you have to do is look at higher education through the lens of the SAT and the ACT. You know, if you got enough money, you can basically hire people to come in and work with your kid until he gets these numbers up to high enough to get into any school he wants to. But if you start off and you don't have enough money to pay those people that do all the training, you're not likely to get that done. And I don't know if you've read this book, Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart. It's a really good story. Murray's a controversial economist.
Right, the bell curve. We've talked about him.
But Coming Apart is a story about how the elites have moved further and further away from everybody else. He grew up in a little town in Iowa where Mr. Maytag lived.
The Maytag man.
No, this is Mr. Maytag that started the company.
Oh, really?
Right. And he lived in that slightly larger house in that part of town. And he was making about three times what his employees is making. And now Mr. Maytag retires and they get a new CEO and I don't want to live in the little town anymore. I'm going to go to the big city of Des Moines. And then a new city CEO comes in, I'm going to go to Chicago. And then a new CEO comes in and I'm going to go to New York. And the comp for the new CEO is like, I don't know, 400 or 500 times what the average guy is making. And their kids are going to Yale and Stanford and Princeton and so forth. And you get this cycling of elites that move further and further away from everybody else. So he has a test in which he says, okay, we're going to find out whether you're an elite or not. Answer the following questions. Have you ever worn the uniform of the United States of America? Raise your hand. Have you ever had a job where you went home at night and you were in pain? Raise your hand. Do you have a friend who's an evangelical Christian? Raise your hand. Have you ever watched Duck Dynasty? Raise your hand. You ask a series of questions, and it's pretty easy to see who the elites are. So his argument is the elites have to make an effort. You were talking about NYU and these two women that were saying all the luxury is on display and you know who the rich kids are. You probably know who the rich kids are because of the way they're behaving. Rich kids have an obligation. They need to understand what noblesse oblige is all about. To those who are given a lot is expected.
Senator Kerry, please stick around. I want to ask you a few more questions before you go, and we're going to make this available to our Hidden Forces subscribers. I have a few more questions I want to ask you about politics today and also your experience on the 9/11 Commission. So stick around.
Okay.
And that was my episode with Senator Bob Kerry. I want to thank the senator for being on my program. Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Edge Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.